You're about to hear a trailer for a podcast I highly recommend. Check out Murder Mile UK True Crime Podcast on the podcast app you're using to listen right now.
Nominated as one of the best British true crime podcasts, Murder Mile is hailed as a masterpiece of compelling storytelling. Research using the original police files. Over 300 episodes, Murder Mile has covered hundreds of crimes you won't hear anywhere else. As well as solving cold cases, unearthing new evidence, and even discovering a serial killer no one even knew existed. For a truly original podcast, subscribe to Murder Mile.
The van trundles down the road, through the bank of fog. If it had been just a little thicker, they may not have seen him. But they did, of course. And as he knew they would, they stopped. In that moment, he has a choice. Go through with it, or walk away. But for him, there was no choice. The money was always going to be his, no matter what he had to do to get it. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 193, The Hildeström Prison Murders. Make upgrading your home security a priority with Ring's range of smart security devices, indoor and outdoor cameras, video doorbells and alarms. Ring products are easy to install and allow you to monitor your home from your phone or tablet via the Ring app, no matter where you are. With cameras in strategic locations, indoors and outdoors, you can create a ring of security around your property. Ring security devices boast advanced features, including live view, two-way talk, motion-activated alerts, and night vision. Available at Takealot, Incredible Connection, Hersh's, and other major retailers. Shout-outs to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Dina, Harbour Balde, Kathy Bezadenhout, Jamie and Casey for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. This episode was first published in the Patreon feed in May 2023. This is one of those cases that's not what you think when you hear the summary. If you're anything like me, when I first heard that this case was about three prison wardens from Hildeström in the Western Cape who were murdered while they were on duty, you'd immediately think that the perpetrator was an incarcerated offender, either trying to escape or carrying out some sort of gang hit. But you, like me, would be wrong. The murders of these three young wardens were sparked by something very different, and almost far more insidious than prison violence. And while they may have signed up for the job knowing that they were going to be in a dangerous environment, they could never have expected that the danger would come from where it did. In researching this case, I used an episode of Opsie se Spoor, as well as several media articles. So, let's get into episode 193, The Hildeström Prison Murders.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Adolf van Weingart was 25 years old in 1999. He'd been working for the Department of Correctional Services for a few years and had married the love of his life 2 years before. They welcomed their first son, Corne, in 1998, and Adolf and his wife were enjoying being newlyweds and new parents to their beautiful little boy. Adolf's parents describe him as hardworking and kind, and a young man who, despite working with some really dangerous offenders, always managed to see the best in people. He'd become a prison warden because he wanted to be part of the solution. He wanted to help offenders become rehabilitated and live successful lives when they left prison. Adolf's wife describes him as the best husband anyone could wish for. She says that she felt like the luckiest woman on earth to have found and married Adolf because he was always respectful to her and treated her as his equal and partner and never tried to push her into being a housewife, for instance, if that's not what she wanted, as she'd seen in many of her friends' marriages. She was grateful and happy and had no idea what was coming for her. Adolf's co-worker, Howard Adams, was the youngest of the team at just 22. He still lived with his parents, Cynthia and Ronald, and his sister also worked at the Haldenstrom Correctional Facility. Howard's parents are clearly very proud of their son. Even as they speak with the producers of Opsia Sespoor 21 years after his murder. They say that although Howard trusted people quite easily, his job at the prison had taught him to be a little more discerning, and he was slowly finding a midpoint between his naturally trusting nature and being more careful about who he let into his life. While Adolf and Howard's parents agreed to speak about their lost children, the parents of Samantha May, who was just 23 years old, found it a bridge too far. Really, this speaks to the different experiences that families of victims have around this type of complicated grief. For some, sharing memories of their murdered loved ones is helpful, despite still being painful and difficult. For others, though, sharing publicly is a bridge too far. For some, it takes them backward in their healing journey, and that needs to be respected too. If a family is willing and able to talk about their loved one, that should be embraced. If another family prefers to keep their memories and feelings to themselves, that too should be embraced. It certainly doesn't mean that they are not standing up for their loved one or honoring their memory just as much as someone who is able to speak publicly. They just need to do it differently. We do know some quite important things about Samantha, and I'll share those a little later in the episode. There are qualities that she shouldn't ever have had to display, but ones that tell us a lot about who she was as a person. Haldenstrom Correctional Facility at the time had residential facilities for those staff members who needed them while they were on duty. It also had a recreational club at which staff members could gather after their shifts and relax and enjoy a drink or a meal. The club accepted cash as payment, and some staff members paid their monthly tabs with checks. So at the end of every month, it would be the responsibility of some of the wardens to take the cash and checks to be deposited into the prison's bank account in Caledon, about half an hour's drive from the prison. On the 29th of August 1999, the task fell to three wardens from Haldenstrom: Adolf van Weingart, Howard Adams, and Samantha May. The three were given one of the prison's minibuses to use, and although the wardens are usually not armed with guns while on duty, all were licensed to carry and use firearms when necessary. And for security purposes, on the day of the bank drop-off, Howard Adams, who would be driving the vehicle, was armed with a 9mm handgun. That Friday morning, the three left the prison premises early. As they loaded the cash and checks from the rec club into the minibus and all got in, they had no idea that someone was watching. While their seatbelts clicked into place and they settled in for the drive, the prison gates opened and they drove out. The man who was watching them made a phone call. On the quiet road to Caledon, another man's cell phone rang. He answered and was given the information he'd been waiting for. The minibus was on its way. The earnings from the rec club were far higher that month than they usually were. He wasn't sure of the exact amount, but sources had told him that there was close to 60,000 rand in cash in the minibus. As the prison minibus containing the three young wardens trundled along the road, the man put his plan into action. He pulled his car out onto the side of the road and pointed it in the direction facing where the minibus would be travelling from. He got out and popped the hood of his car. Then he leaned in from the side, pretended to be fiddling in his engine, and waited. He would not have to wait very long. Around 9:15 a.m., the man heard the sound of a vehicle. A quick glance told him it was the white minibus emblazoned with the logo of Haldenstrom Correctional Facility. He made a show of fiddling around under the hood and then stepped out slightly into the road and waved his hands at the driver. Howard Adams slowed down. At 9:30 a.m., a call came into the switchboard at Haldenstrom Prison. At first, the switchboard operator thought it was a wrong number or a prank call. The voice on the other side was nothing more than a whisper. Her first instinct, as multiple calls came in on other lines, was to end the call and pick up the others. But something told her to listen more carefully. Then she heard it. "Einke," the whispered voice crackled through the line. "Einke, we need help." The operator finally recognized the voice as 23-year-old warden Samantha May. Samantha was the daughter of the deputy prison director. The man had been with the prison for most of his career, and the operator and many of the staff members there had seen her grow up and then begin her own career in the prison. As the operator listened, his stomach clenched. Samantha struggled to get the words out, but horror filled the woman as she heard Sam say, "We've been shot. We're bleeding to death." Then Samantha gave the operator her location and the full name of the man who'd shot them. Thick fog was still hanging over the road between Haldenstrom and Caledon that morning as a convoy of vehicles sped out the prison gates. After the operator had relayed the information to her superior, she'd been instructed to phone Samantha back and keep her on the line until help arrived. But when she called, the number just rang. The location the young woman had provided must have seemed clear in her mind at the time, but perhaps in the haze of her pain and shock, she didn't realize that they were now on a side road and not visible from the main road at all, and especially not in that fog. The team from the prison and the SAPS, who'd been summoned, searched along the road in vain for almost an hour. Eventually, it would be a local farmer who'd heard about the search on his radio and set out to assist, who discovered the minibus. The man would later describe in court how he'd approached the minibus with caution. Details of the alleged crime at the time had been minimal, but he'd heard that there'd been a weapon involved, and he didn't know if the perpetrators were still on the scene. He called out, but received no response. And then he saw blood dripping from the back of the vehicle. When he opened the van, he discovered a scene of horror inside. The interior of the vehicle was covered in blood. Inside, he found three deceased victims. 23-year-old Samantha May lay with her cell phone nearby. The missed calls from the prison still on her screen. The driver of the vehicle, Howard Adams, had clearly struggled with the perpetrator after being shot at least once. His blood was found throughout the van, and his life was then taken with another two gunshots. It would be determined that the weapon that had been used to kill the three victims, which had included Adolf von Feinhardt, had likely been the same gun issued to Howard Adams that morning when he left the prison premises. The weapon was missing from the vehicle, and it was assumed it had been removed by the perpetrator. Sadly, all three victims were long past any hope of resuscitation. Samantha May's father had been aware of the situation almost from the moment his daughter had made the call to the prison switchboard operator, and soon he received confirmation that his daughter had passed away. Adolf von Feinhardt's father was driving when he received a cell phone call, informing him that his son had been involved in what appeared to be a hijacking. He was informed that Adolf had been shot and he had not survived. The caller had asked him to pull over before delivering the news, and after the notification asked Yanni for his location so that they could send someone to drive him back home. He declined, though, and with 1,000 questions raging through his mind, he turned around and drove back home to break the news to his wife. Howard Adams' mother clearly remembered the Friday on which she'd received the worst news of her life. She'd just gone to do some grocery shopping with her daughter and then picked up her grandchild from nursery school. When she returned back home, her landline was ringing. It was her son's girlfriend, who told her that Howard had been shot at work. She was asked to go through to the hospital. At that point, she didn't know the exact details of what had happened, nor did she know what Howard's condition was. It was upon her arrival at the hospital that she would be informed that her son had died. As three families imploded that day and faced an uncertain future, each without one of their members, the Haldenstrom Correctional Facility was in shock. Not just because they had lost three of their members that very morning, but also because at that very moment, a manhunt was on for the man who Samantha May had named. And he too was a prison warden. As Samantha May had lay dying, with the last of her strength, she delivered a message to the switchboard operator about the identity of the man who'd shot them. His name, she'd said, was Sean Fucht. 27-year-old Sean Fucht was a warden in the maximum security section of Haldenstrom Prison. He'd known Samantha, Howard, and Adolf very well. He'd worked with them for several years. On Thursday, the 28th of August, Sean Fucht had advised his supervisor that he would not be able to come into work the next day. He said he'd had some personal matters he needed to attend to. It would be alleged that the personal matter he intended to carry out that Friday was the robbery of the three co-workers who were carrying close to 60,000 rand in cash to be deposited in the bank. When the SAPS was provided with the information about Samantha May's dying testimony, they immediately sprang into action and began to trace Sean Fucht. He would be arrested by 1 p.m. that afternoon, and the cash would be recovered from his home. Sean Vocht, though, claimed to be horrified to hear that his three co-workers were dead. He admitted having knowledge of the robbery, but claimed that it was another man who'd killed the three victims. During his first interview with police, it would emerge that Sean Vocht had not been the only Haldenstrom prison employee to betray his co-workers that day. Another man, Donnie van Schalkwyk, had been the informant. He'd had knowledge of the amounts of money being transported that day, as well as when the minibus was leaving and the route they'd be taking. Cell phone records showed that he'd phoned Sean Vocht twice that day. Once in the morning when the minibus left, and again after Samantha had sounded the alarm and van Schalkwyk saw the convoy of vehicles rushing out the gate. But it wasn't van Schalkwyk who Vocht was accusing of the murders. He claimed that a mechanic from Worcester, Jacobus Opperman, not an employee of the prison, had been the one who'd killed his colleagues. Vocht claimed that Opperman had picked him up that morning as they were going to commit the robbery together. Vocht said he didn't want to be present during the robbery because his colleagues would recognize him. So the plan was for Opperman to drop him off on the side of the road and then commit the robbery. He claimed that nothing had been said about murder and Opperman had not been armed to his knowledge. He also claimed that he didn't know any of the wardens were going to be armed either. But when Opperman had picked him up later, he'd figured that something had gone wrong. He then started to get phone calls from people asking where he was, and he'd heard that he'd been implicated in the murders in Samantha's dying phone call. Vocht insisted he was not the trigger man. Van Schalkwyk and Opperman were also arrested, and as the three appeared in court for the first time, the SAPS were using physical evidence to paint a picture of the truth. Donnie van Schalkwyk admitted to having given Vocht information about the minibus, the cash, and phoning him that morning to tell him the wardens were on their way. He denied knowing that Howard Adams was armed, and he also said that Sean Vocht had never indicated he was going to hurt anyone. It would later emerge that on the day of the murders, Howard Adams' family had visited the prison after receiving the news of his murder to get more information about what had happened. As they'd driven out, Donnie van Schalkwyk had stopped them and expressed his deep sorrow for their loss. They were floored to discover he'd been involved all along. Jacobus Opperman denied any involvement in the crimes. He said that he had picked up Vocht on the side of the road that day, but he'd had no idea that the man had just committed three murders. Cell phone records would tell a very specific story. Donnie van Schalkwyk was found to have remained at the prison the entire time. Jacobus Opperman's cell phone did travel with Sean Vocht's cell phone during parts of the day, but at no point was his cell phone in the same spot as the victim's. Sean Vocht's phone, however, was at the exact same location as the cell phones of the three victims. Although he claimed that Opperman had given him the cash, the fact that Opperman could not be placed at the scene, and Vocht could, meant that this story could not be believed. And of course, there was the testimony of one of the victims, a voice from the grave, that was the most damning. Although when the trial started against the three later that year, all three pled not guilty, and Sean Vocht's defense attorney did his best to have Samantha May's phone call excluded from evidence on the basis of it being hearsay and her not being present to be cross-examined, the judge allowed the evidence. Prosecutor Susan Galloway would later argue that Samantha May had no reason to falsely accuse her colleague as she lay dying. Vocht's own conflicting accounts also did not make him look very good. Although initially admitting to a role in the robbery, during the trial he attempted to claim that he'd actually had nothing to do with it, and that the only reason his cell phone pinged in the same area as the victim's that day was because he'd been hitchhiking to work that morning on the same road. When asked why he would be doing this if he'd already asked for a day's leave, Focht claimed he'd changed his mind and decided to go into work after all. Howard Adams's mother raised a very important issue that stood against Focht's version, though. She said that there was no way that Howard would stop for a stranger. Since working at the prison, he'd become very security conscious, and he knew very well what risk was involved in stopping for someone on the side of the road. She'd been in a vehicle with him before when they'd seen hitchhikers, and although Howard always expressed regrets that he couldn't help, he would never stop. It was for this reason, she said, that she knew Sean Focht was lying, and it was not Jacobus Opperman that had hijacked the van. The van was in perfect condition and had not been damaged in any way in order to cause it to stop. Howard had clearly stopped the vehicle on purpose to attend to something or someone on the side of the road. He would only have done that, his mother said, if he recognized the person, knew them, and trusted them. He did not know Jacobus Opperman, but he did know Sean Focht. Additionally, Sean Focht's wife would testify that her husband had dressed in his prison warden uniform that Friday morning. This uniform would, of course, be instantly recognizable to Howard and the other wardens. And the minute they saw it, they would have slowed down. And then, upon recognizing the person in the uniform, they would have stopped. All three men were initially charged with murder and robbery. As we've seen in some cash in transits and murder for hire cases before, you don't need to be the one with the gun in your hands to be found guilty of murder. If you're part of a group whose intention it is to commit a crime which could reasonably result in the death or serious injury of another person, you can be convicted of murder. For Van Schalkwyk's defense, the key in getting their clients off on a lesser charge was to prove that he could not have foreseen the murder of the three individuals he'd aided in robbing. As evidence was laid out that it was uncommon for the wardens to be armed and that this had been a one-off event because there'd been so much money in the vehicle, it seemed a fair point that Van Schalkwyk was as horrified as everyone else at the turn of events. He had honestly believed, perhaps naively, that the money would just be handed over and no one would get hurt. Sean Focht and Jacobus Opperman were unable to prove that their involvement was in any way minimized, and by the end of the trial in March 2001, Focht was found guilty of all three murders and robbery. Opperman was found guilty of the robbery and a lesser charge of accessory to commit murder. The judge believed that he'd been aware that violence may be required to achieve the robbery, and he'd assisted Focht after the fact. Van Schalkwyk was found guilty of the robbery, but not guilty of the murder charges. Sean Focht was handed down three life sentences. The families of the three slain wardens were satisfied with the sentence at the time. Unfortunately, they didn't know that in 2004, a ruling called the Van Wyk judgments would be passed down, which would mean that Focht would benefit from the fact that his life sentences were handed down in 2001, prior to 2004. His minimum served sentence before he became eligible for parole would be far less than future life sentence recipients. But in 2001, still aching from the raw grief, that was not yet a consideration for the May, Adams and Van Wynkaart families. Adolf Van Wynkaart's parents' home is filled with photographs of him. They explain to producers of Opsius Spoor that he remains an important and celebrated part of their family. Adolf's son had just turned one when he lost his father. He has no memories of his dad. And he says that it is this that hurts the most. When his grandparents and mom talk about his dad and have the benefits of the joy of memories, he has nothing. He says that he's found it very difficult to come to terms with the loss. And even 21 years later, as they're interviewing him, he admits feeling deep hatred for Sean Vocht. Although Vocht did not immediately exercise his right to appeal, in 2012, he surprised everyone by making an application to appeal both his conviction and his sentence. Vocht insisted that the judge in his case had been biased and that the evidence he'd presented had not been understood. He also said that the evidence his co-accused had presented had been incorrectly interpreted. In addition, he once again insisted that Samantha May's telephone call to the prison in which she implicated him should not have been accepted as evidence. Vocht represented himself in the appeal, and prosecutor Susan Galloway stood for the state before Judge John Chlope. Vocht's appeal was summarily dismissed. It's likely that when Vocht made this attempt at appeal, he didn't realize that the sentence he'd been handed down was timed in his favor in terms of South African law. And just 3 years later, in 2015, he and the families of the victims were advised that he was now eligible for parole. Just 16 years after murdering three people in their early 20s, Sean Vocht sat with the victims' families for a victim-offender dialogue, or VOD. This is always a very difficult period of engagement for those who have lost loved ones in this way. It can be useful to the grieving and healing process, but only if the offender in question is willing to be truthful and has reached a point of true remorse for all of their actions, and not just the fact that they were caught. In Vocht's case, despite pleading his innocence for more than a decade and just 3 years before attempting to have his entire conviction overturned, when the VOD came around, he was suddenly willing to admit his guilt. At least, his version of that. Again, Howard Adams' mother was not going to be fooled. She didn't just see things on a surface level. And despite Vocht attempting to get his alleged remorse across, when she asked him one question that had always bugged her, his response was concerning. She told Sean that she knew he'd known Howard well. They'd been friendly, and Howard had even given Sean lifts to and from work on occasion. She wanted to know how Sean had been capable of looking her son in the eye, having him recognize him, and then so cold-bloodedly firing three bullets into him. Sean Vocht didn't miss a beat. He claimed that Howard didn't know it was him because he wore a balaclava. At that moment, she knew Vocht was not rehabilitated and had no true remorse because he was very clearly lying. She tells the producers of Op See Ses Spoor that there was no way her son was going to stop his vehicle for a man dressed in prison warden clothing but also wearing a balaclava. In fact, he wouldn't have stopped his vehicle for anyone wearing a balaclava. He would have called police. At that moment, the VOD was over for Howard's mom. Adolf van Veenhardt's son, Corneille, then so close to the same age his dad was when he was murdered, forced himself to attend the VOD even though he really didn't want to. He says that when Vocht looked at him, he teared up and said he could see his father in him. That more than anything actually angered the young man, because his father's murderer was able to see that. But thanks to him, he could never recognize his father in himself, because that opportunity had been stolen from him. When it came the young man's turn to speak, all he could muster was, "I don't forgive you. I have only hatred for you. On that initial occasion, Sean Vocht's parole was denied. The families were assured that they would be advised if Vocht were to be eligible for parole, or worse yet, given the green light for release. After the families left that day, in the ensuing 4 years, Sean Vocht would be considered for parole another 4 times. In 2019, the Adams family heard through a friend that Sean Vocht had been released from prison. In fact, he'd already been on parole since July 2018. The Department of Correctional Services would later release a statement confirming that in that month, Vocht had been given a 3-month trial day parole period, and after that day parole was successfully completed, he was released on parole, which would be effective for the rest of his life. The families of the victims say that they were not advised, while the Department of Corrections says they did their due diligence in the matter. Adolf von Weinkart's widow says that she received a call one day telling her that Vocht had been released. The person on the other side had wanted to give her information about where Vocht was working and living, and she stopped them. For her own reasons, she said, she didn't want to know where Vocht was. And herein lies the clear difference again in how people deal with grief. Many family members of victims do want to know exactly where these offenders are because they want to be able to avoid them if possible. But for Adolf's wife, the information would be a burden. Perhaps she'd feel that she'd have to share that information with her son. And perhaps she was concerned about how much anger the young man still had in his heart toward Vocht. Maybe it was easier for her not to be able to picture the man out in the world, only in his 40s, still with an entire life ahead of him, working, living, loving, getting to hug his family, having the opportunity to still have children if you wanted to. All the things that were stolen from Samantha, Adolf, and Howard. Although there are still a few offenders in the system who will benefit from the time period during which they committed their crimes, thankfully they are becoming fewer and fewer. Because I cannot imagine how difficult it is for the families of these victims to see the perpetrators serve such short prison sentences when they were handed down life sentences. 20 years behind bars for 3 lives is an absolute travesty, regardless of whether Vocht never commits another crime again. And it only deepens the pain of the loss of those young lives so unnecessarily, for nothing more than greed. Those 3 young people did sign up for a relatively dangerous job, but they and their loved ones thought they knew where the danger would come from. In their minds, they could take precautions to ensure they were safe from the often dangerous criminals they helped to keep incarcerated. Never in a million years could they have imagined the real danger would come from one of their own. Adolf von Weinkart left his family that morning, kissed his wife and little boy goodbye, and likely looked back with a smile, grateful for the good life he had. His little boy would eventually grow into a strong young man, very similar to his dad, but Adolf would only get to share 12 months with him. Howard Adams was clearly deeply loved by his family. The young man took charge that day and drove the vehicle. When he saw Vocht on the side of the road, he didn't hesitate to help his co-worker, who seemed stranded. He recognized his face, and he thought he knew him. But just minutes later, when Vocht overpowered him and took his weapon, turning it on him and his co-workers, Howard realized he had absolutely no idea who Sean Vocht was. In his last moments, he tried to fight back, but Focht was too strong for Howard's weakened body, and his last sight was the eyes of a man who had so deeply betrayed him. Samantha May died a hero, although I'm sure that fact holds little, if any, solace for her family. She was slipping in and out of consciousness from shock, pain, and blood loss when she reached for her cell phone. But in that moment, there was no way she was going to let Focht get away with what he'd done. After hanging up, she slipped away. But her voice remained to speak about the greed and selfishness that had stolen their lives that day. And although her killer now walks free, he can't escape her voice. She knew it was you, and she made sure everyone else knew too. And no matter where you go and what you get to do that they don't, you have to live with that. Adolf van Veenhardt, Howard Adams, Samantha May, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.